This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray.
We are friends and reality dating show fans, and the only thing we love as much as love stories is lovingly snarking on them.
Whether you love love or love to hate it, listen to Love to See It, our podcast dissecting all the romance we see on screen.
From reality dating shows like The Bachelor and Love is Blind to classic rom-coms like You've Got Mail, we recap in obsessive detail and unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
Listen to Love to See It on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tuomas Iisalo will be the new permanent head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies. You had indicated all along you thought this was the way it was going to go. I guess we didn't know it was going to happen on that Friday, right? Like, it's that was the only surprise,
right?
That just happened then?
Yeah, I mean, timing seems neither here nor there. The only question was going to be, were they going to, like, quote-unquote, have a coaching search and interview other people? It felt like they'd already sort of determined that's what they were going to do. And so, you know, when Dave Yeager got elevated, you know, after Lionel Hollins was not retained, they sort of went through the charade, if you want to be ungenerous, of having a coaching search. But they sort of always knew they were hiring Dave Yeager. And so this time they just did it. Different they in terms of management in those two situations, but same owner, same organization. And so I think they always knew that's what they were doing. And my interpretation of, you know, Zach Kleiman said at the final media session, you know, I haven't made a decision on the coaching thing. I think that was, I needed to digest the season or whatever. I think, near as I can tell, that really just meant we're going through exit interviews over the course of the day and we're talking to the players. And so we're going to do all that before we do anything, but I think that was like the final ribbon was going through the exit interviews and then having whatever your negotiation was going to be with Iisalo.
In terms of the always knew what they were going to do, like, do you believe, how far back does this go? Like, when they gave him the interim job, when they hired him last summer? Like, how do you parse that out? There's lots of conspiracy theories that when they hired him last summer, they always knew he was going to be the head coach someday.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that counts as a conspiracy.
Okay.
I mean, but yeah, I think when they made the change from Jenkins to Iisalo as the interim, I think at that point the operating assumption, I'm guessing, was that in the absence of something that would change their minds, that it was going to head towards Iisalo being the head coach. And I characterize that, and what I wrote over the weekend, it's less an audition than a test run. You've already decided you're going to buy the car unless you see something you don't like. And so you take it out on a test run just to make sure you don't change your mind. And so, you know, you sort of know what you're doing, but your mind could change based on your experience of the thing itself. And so you take it on the test run and make sure that what you're seeing is what you expect to see out of it. And if it is, that's what you're going to do. And so I think that was sort of it. Now, when they made the hire last summer, I don't think that was with the intention of a coaching change, but I do think that was with the knowledge that, you know, this season, I think we all knew going into the season that this was sort of, the microscope was going to really be on Jenkins here in year six of his coaching run. And so I think, you know, as of last summer, I think they knew that it wasn't a certainty they were going to be keeping Jenkins, you know, for more than the next season. I don't think that decision had been made, otherwise they would have made it. And I think if this team were like, you know, Cleveland. Oklahoma City,
yeah, yeah,
right now, or Cleveland or whatever, like, there would not have been a coaching change. So I don't think it was like, you know, it was stated or it was determined that this was always going to happen going back last summer.
Right. I mean, there's something to be said for getting smart people in an organization, period. And there's no question their preference would have been for it to be wildly successful and for it to be like Cleveland. Keith Parrish asked on Twitter, he said, as a thought experiment, though, it would be interesting to see what could have happened during his interim coaching stint where he wouldn't have gotten the head coaching job? And I think the answer to that's pretty simple, isn't it? Really, like, one thing that could have happened is the players didn't like him, right? Like, in the end,
that's the biggest thing. That's the number one thing.
Yeah.
If there had been some kind of, you know, tissue rejection from the players for you know, believing in him or following his lead, then that's the number one thing that would have changed it. You know, if he'd gone, you know, instead of 5-6 or whatever it was before the playoff series, if he'd gone 0-11, which I guess, you know, maybe that would not have been possible. 0-10, I guess, is the worst it could have been. Like, maybe that changes everything. And if they're getting, like, blown out of the building every game and things get worse. Things didn't get worse. Things got, I think, slightly better, but only slightly better. But I think the real and Klieman said this on the day, you know, in his brief comments after the change. He said, "What I'm looking for is clarity of direction." And I think implicit in that was they knew they were dealing these slow a bad hand to play, in that the team was having all kinds of the team was sort of coming apart a little bit. The schedule was about to get tougher in the middle of this tight playoff race. You'd already lost Brandon Clark at the point you made the change. And so they weren't expecting some 180-degree dramatic turnaround in the way the team was playing. They were looking for that clarity of direction. They were looking for a guy who would follow up on their belief that he'd be comfortable in that role, that he would command the players' attention, that he would be what sort of they thought he was going to be, and they thought he was that.
I'd urge people to read the piece that you wrote about him, but let's focus on those games that he did coach. What promising things did you see from those games that he did coach, or even just the way he carried himself and communicated about basketball?
Well, I think the team had been on a downward trend. I mean, there's a lot there in the second part, but in terms of the on-court stuff, the team had been on a downward trend, in that not only were they struggling to beat the good teams, they were increasingly struggling to compete with the good teams. They were losing by more to the good teams, and then they were starting to lose to the bad teams they'd been beating most of the season, right? And so you lose double digits to Sacramento, or bad to mediocre teams, some 500 teams. You lose double digits to Sacramento on the eve of that coaching change. You lose double digits to Portland. You're sort of handled, you know, you lose double digits, obviously, to the Clippers, to the Thunder. You lose at home to the Spurs. You lose at home to the Hawks. And so there was slippage, even from the earlier, like, you know, we can't beat the good teams, but we handled the bad teams. There's been slippage from that. And I think if you look at the way the team performed relative to the schedule under Isolo, that did shore up and get better. They still only beat one winning team, and that was at Detroit. But, like, they were in the mix up until the end in most of these games, right? They just couldn't close the deal. Like, they're within 5 points or less with 2 minutes to go against the Lakers, against the Warriors twice, against another team I'm forgetting who was in that mix, Denver, against the Thunder in both the home games, etc. And so the team got more consistently competitive. They just couldn't get over the hump. I think Isolo showed some good stuff in terms of managing fouls, which I've talked about, and maximizing playing time that way. I think he showed some good stuff in general game planning. I think good stuff with Edie, good stuff with Pippen. And in terms of the way he communicates about basketball, I mean, I think that's sort of a big part of it. And you want to see evidence of, like, that mattering to players and not mattering to, say, a media person or a front office person.
Yeah.
But I think there's a real, I mean, to steal a phrase from Hamilton that Hamilton stole from the West Wing, you're looking for the evidence of a sign of a mind at work, right? And that you really saw that with him. I mean, I didn't write anything about this kind of stuff in my column, because I sort of separate, like, what's interesting or for me and what, like, matters for coaching. And I don't know how much it matters to players or fans whether I like listening to a guy talk, but I really do. I am attracted to the way he thinks, and not just, like, his specific opinions about basketball, but the way he processes ideas and the way he thinks about things, you can get that in his communication. And like Drew had a quote in his story, which is very good. A lot of overlap between my story and Drew, but not total. People should read them both. I recommend Drew's story is great. And there's a quote Drew used that I think it was in response to the 5-second call he'd gotten in the play-in against Golden State, who basically said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing and filling in some gaps. He basically said, you know, we haven't had a lot of practice time. We only have these shoot-arounds. There's only so much time we've been able to have, and we've been focused on the things that matter the most, not the things that are going to get the most attention. He's basically saying, you know, that the things that are going to impact the game, that we haven't had a lot of time to focus on late game execution specific stuff because we've only had so much time. We're focusing on the things that matter the most, even if you don't notice them. And just that idea of thinking about, like, asking simple questions. Like, is something true? Is something not true? What does this thing actually matter more than that thing? And getting away from, like, narrative and cliche and all that kind of stuff. I'm just really attracted to the way he thinks.
And you see the same way when he talks about Zach Edey, same thing. He talks about what matters, what doesn't matter, the loud mistakes that he makes, et cetera. He talks sort of right. In much the same way. I was just to go back to the Jaren stuff really quickly and the foul trouble. Obviously, we've talked before about how you like the way that he has approached handling foul trouble. But I did think the one stat in your column was really interesting that he had four games that he coached in which Jaren ended up with five fouls. And in those four games that he coached where Jaren ended up with five fouls, Jaren played an average of 37 minutes. And then I guess you went back and looked at the last four games that Taylor Jenkins coached where Jaren ended up with five fouls. And in those four games, Jaren played an average of 24 minutes.
And that's somewhat anecdotal, and I'm not cherry picking. I'm going for the most recent four games. I don't want to take the time to look at every single game and over 6 years of Taylor Jenkins coach for which Jaren had five fouls. But I thought, like, I watch all the games, and so I know that pattern is real because I would complain about it in real time all the time, where Jaren would get in quote unquote foul trouble and suddenly, like, Jenkins is, like, not playing him for, like, 12 straight minutes and, like, doing everything he can to save him for the end. And then, like, you know, he plays 28 minutes and the team loses by 10, and who cares? And I think Isolo sort of saw the logical flaw in all that, and he articulated it. He didn't see it. He articulated it. And then he acted accordingly. And now, when you get into early next season, is that necessarily going to be happening? No, because I don't think he's going to be playing Jaren 37 minutes even with zero fouls early next season. But in terms of in the moment and understanding, like, you know, the value proposition there of quote unquote the end of the game versus, like, just getting minutes from the guys you want to get minutes from, I think he sort of understood that and acted accordingly. And to me, that's indicative of a lot of stuff with him in terms of just the way he processes stuff.
You mentioned in the piece that the Grizzlies have hired first time, given coaches a chance to have their first NBA head coaching job before, and the situations where it's worked has been with Jaeger and with Jenkins, where they had been at least a head coach at a different level. And so they knew what head coaching was about, even if it wasn't at the NBA. The cases where it didn't work, Fizdale and Ivoroni, and honestly, J.B. Bickerstaff had been an interim, but he'd never been a head coach before. That was, they had been just basically career assistants. Now, whatever, all of this is anecdotal. It is also interesting, though, Chris, that if
Bickerstaff had a pretty long run as interim head coach, so he had had that head coaching experience to some degree.
So it is interesting, though. Like, you know what's been 100% successful for the Grizzlies? Hiring an actual head coach. Fratello, Hubie, and Lionel. Like, they're 100%.
Right.
Do you find there's anything to be, like, would it have been, I don't know what's safe and what isn't safe, to hire an experienced actual head coach here? Is that a reason?
I think it would be perfectly reasonable for the Grizzlies to go out and hire a guy like that, right? And I think that's what a lot of fans want. There's no such thing as safe, though.
No.
I mean, it's easy to say that, but then, like, you know,
look at Phoenix.
I mean, was it safe when Detroit hired Monty Williams? Like, they went out and hired it was a total disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they went and hired Doc Smith, proven, you know, NBA coach of the year, and been a head coach multiple stops, and winner proven, and it was a total disaster. You know, Mike Budenholzer, like, didn't work out. It's easy to have opinions about this stuff, but really none of us know.
Yeah.
And it could work, some things, it could work out or not work out no matter who you hire, but I do think you're right that you know, you know someone has the ability to be a head coach when they've been a head coach. Whether it would work out for you or not, it's a separate question, but you do know that. But I do think, I wrote a similar thing back when they hired Jenkins 6 years ago. I do think there's a track record to show, and again, it's not total. There are plenty of examples of guys who are just career assistants and then become good head coaches. But I do think that head coaching experience at other pro levels is more applicable to being a head coach in the NBA than being an assistant in the NBA. I think there's a pattern there to go from that. There's a bigger difference between being an assistant coach in the NBA and a head coach in the NBA than there is between being a head coach in the NBA and a head coach in some other professional setting.
A couple other things. One is you pointed out that this suggests that they're leaning into Ja. You can listen to all the national podcasts who have him traded somewhere else all you want. It feels like this is a lot of this is about unlocking Ja.
I think the only way Ja, yes, I think this is a signal that they're committed to Ja Morant as the fulcrum of the team next season. I think the only way that Ja Morant is not with the Grizzlies, there's only two ways Ja Morant's not with the Grizzlies next season. One is that he asked to not be here, and I don't think that's going to happen. And two is that someone makes an offer that's like so above and beyond that the Grizzlies say, huh, okay. And I really don't think that's going to happen, given his recent right. history with injuries and off-court stuff and everything else. And so I just think, you know, and I could be wrong about this, and those are the two ways I could be wrong, but I don't think either of those things are going to happen, and I think the Grizzlies' focus is going to be maximizing Ja Morant next season.
The Jaren stuff is interesting, and you pointed out that players like Jaren don't really exist that he's coaches before. Like, you ball-dominant point guards and bigs.
If they do, they're 18, 19 years old, and they're about to be headed to the NBA.
Right. So how much is that?
Like Wimby.
Right. How much of a challenge is that going to be? Figuring out the well, – which has been a challenge for every head coach, honestly. The right balance between Ja, Jaren, how you get the best of each of them simultaneously. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a welcome challenge, right?
Right.
It's a challenge that I think he should embrace, and I think he will embrace, again, assuming that Jaren's back. And I think Jaren's back in the absence of other things that could happen but aren't likely. I think Ja Morant is the most talented guy on the team, especially on the offensive end, in terms of being an engine of an offense. But I do wonder about over-reliance on Ja Morant's off-the-dribble scoring. And, you know, to me, Jaren has proven, maybe not in the last 3 minutes of a tight game, but over the course of a season, to be as reliable a one-on-one scorer, maybe, with the leaps he's taken. And then also, I feel like the Grizzlies are at the best when you're maximizing Ja's passing. To me, the best version of the Grizzlies when the Grizzlies peak over the years has not been when Ja is just making a lot of tough shots in the lane against the tight defense that you ooh and ah over. It's when he's creating easy shots for other people. And like just lob dunks are just flying all over the place, right?
Yep.
To me, that's the best version of Morant for the team. And so I'll be interested to see how Isolo sort of brings all these things together. You know, it'll be a challenge, but it's a good challenge.
And then finally, he had – the part of the Grizzlies' philosophy that did seem to be reflective of Isolo's philosophy early in the season was playing a lot of players and playing your best players lighter minutes in the interest of extracting greater effort or energy or whatever from your players. Play them limited times, you get the very best out of them. He talked about it subsequently. We didn't necessarily see that down the stretch because of the urgency of the games and also the state of the roster. It will be interesting to see how that plays out, given a full training camp and everything else, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is an exchange I had with him very early on, either his first or I think it was his second. It wasn't his pregame availability right after he became the head coach. It was the first postgame availability after his first game. I had this exchange with him, which I've written about and other people have written about, where he basically, like, defended the idea, but then said, but what I do know is that, you know, if you're not playing with the right intensity, it doesn't work, and you have to go the other way. And then he went the other way down the stretch. But the idea of we want to play super fast, super intense, and we're going to do the quick substitutions in the lower minutes so that everyone can go all out all the time when they're on the floor, and we're playing with greater intensity than the other team. That is his philosophy. I think that philosophy was probably easier to maximize in Europe, where the talent disparities maybe were lower. I think what the Grizzlies found this season was that it worked against the bad teams and didn't work as well as against the good teams. I suspect that may continue to be the case, And I think Eastland will probably start out next season trying to do that, but I think what he's shown is a willingness to say, well, never mind, this is not working, let's change. And so that'll be interesting to watch next season.
Yeah, I happened to talk to Pete Pranica over the weekend, and I just asked him his sense, and he emphasized his pragmatism. He thinks of him as a highly pragmatic guy, and so you certainly saw that here. You can read the piece over at the Daily Memphian. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. It's Mother's Day, Jeffrey, bearing down upon us. Were you aware?
My wife did.
She reminded
you?
She reminded
did the...
you because she wanted you to make sure you were you were kind to your mother, or because she is herself a mother?
She's handled my mother and her mother.
Oh, that's
she's taking care of that.
And she wants to make sure that
I take care of my daughter's mother.
Well, I got something for you, because Robert Irwin Jewelers is there for all of you who are celebrating moms, any kind of moms. You got your stay-at-home moms, your stepmoms, your grandmoms, your pet moms, your working moms, like moms, mother-in-laws, like there's moms, 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 all kinds of moms. Doesn't mind the kind of mom that you are celebrating. They'll all be happy if they have a diamond from Robert Irwin Jewelers. Bigger, brighter diamonds during Mother's Day diamond sale going on now. So, for example, 2-carat lab-grown diamond stud earrings. This is kind of crazy. $7.99 while supplies last. To the moon gift set that includes a to the moon and back diamond pennant and 24-carat gold-dipped rose. Only $199. Flexi diamond bangle bracelets. That's a new collection of diamond bangle bracelets. Flexible contour to her wrist from $8.99 to $59.99. They even have a diamond paw necklace for your pet mom, $119. This is the place. Do not tarry. Do not waste time. Make there certain that you celebrate your mom the way she deserves to be celebrated. Free financing, by the way, 12 months, 0% interest, or take up to 60 months to pay. It's Robert Irwin Jewelers, 5 locations, rijewelers.com. Back in a moment, Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.